The topic has been working on politicization of energy security in southeastern Europe, and I'll just say the usual thing. He got his PhD not from LSE, but from another university nearby. Okay, I'll pass it to you.
Thank you. No, just to give you a bit of a background, I did my PhD at King's. I hope it's not a forbidden word here.
No, King's.
It was on energy security, but I was looking at the discourses. So I was not looking at the actual policies, the amount of oil, gas, pipelines, but I was looking at the idea, at the sphere of the elite discourses. So I was looking at newspapers, what newspapers in particular countries were saying about energy, which topics they were raising, how they were framing energy security, how they were explaining it. My ultimate goal, my research, was to show whether there are signs of convergence. I was looking at three different examples, UK, Germany, and Poland, period from 2000 until 2009. So roughly from the moment when the whole debate about diversification of energy in the European Union started until 2009, when the Lisbon Treaty was finally ratified by the very last country. So this was the sort of framework, the methodological framework that I was working on doing my PhD, and this is something I was trying to, in a way, copy looking at Southeastern Europe. So going to the outline of the presentation, initially I wanted to start talking about the energy mixes of countries from Southeastern Europe to give people a bit more information about what sort of resources are they using, oil, gas, or renewable energy. Then to say a few words about the particularities of energy security in Southeast Europe. Go into definitions. There's various conflicting definitions as to what energy security actually means. And then focus on the most interesting aspect of energy security in the Balkans, which is the pipelines. We had what I labeled as a great pipeline rivalry between South Stream and Nabucco. Now we seem to have Turkish Stream, or Turk Stream, as Gazprom likes to call it in its press releases, and the Trans-Adriatic Pipeline. Now the very general observation that I make is at least two of these pipelines is what I called virtual pipelines, so pipelines that actually never materialize, but are present in the discourse, are present in various memoranda papers, but they were actually never built. But I'll go into more details explaining this. What do I understand as virtual pipelines? Then I wanted to say a few words about challenges in terms of energy security in the Western Balkans and Southeast Europe, because actually pipelines and gas is the least of them. There's more serious issues dealing with that. And I wanted to end up with something very positive, because I'll be more critical throughout the whole presentation about the opportunities in terms of energy in Southeast Europe. So to start off with the energy mix, it's very difficult to find reliable data, to be honest, about the actual energy mix of Southeast European countries. The most reliable one is the energy community. Energy community has compiled data of all of the countries of Southeast Europe, so I just borrowed the graphs from their website. They are not very up-to-date, 2013, but it's, again, very difficult to find the reliable data that's up-to-date, published later than 2013. When you look at, starting with Albania, it's mainly oil and petroleum, which is mainly, not mainly, but up to a certain extent is imported, and renewable energy, which is produced in Albania, with hydropower being the biggest of it. When you look at Bosnia-Herzegovina, it's mainly solid fossil fuels, meaning coal, different types of coal, and a bit of renewable energy. Kosovo, it's even more significantly coal-based, with just a slight bit of renewable energy, which is solid biomass. Now, when you look at what experts are saying about renewable energy, many are questioning whether biomass is actually renewable energy, because it's basically, you know, mass that's being burned. Macedonia, similarly, mainly based on coal, with a bit of renewable energy, mainly biomass, a bit of hydropower, just 1% solar.
Can you say what's the difference between the two graphs?
Well, the graph on the left generally presents what the country is producing, the energy or the resources that the country is providing from its own resources. The one on the left is the actual consumption. Yeah, it's not very clear. So it shows, I mean, Macedonia is not producing any oil and petroleum. It's importing all of it. Same goes with gas. The same goes with the previous countries. So the one common theme is, apart from Albania, all of them are importing oil and gas, oil and petroleum products.
And the small circle in the middle is the renewable.
Exactly, and the small circle in the middle is the green one, is always renewable energy, and the small circle in the middle is sort of an explanation what sort of renewables are being used. I can go back to the...
What is solid biomass?
Solid biomass is, for example... that's a good question. It's a difficult question. Solid biomass, for example, different plants. I'm not sure how to explain it in English.
It is crops.
Pretty much. It's pretty much crops. Yeah.
Okay, fine. But that's the stuff that there would have been that controversy about. Because it takes up the space that food is normally grown on. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, harvested wood is also considered biomass. Processed into pellet fuel and other forms of fuel. So this is the controversy when it comes to biomass. I mean, to what extent is it actually renewable when you're burning old wood?
Albania is fairly self-sufficient.
The Albanian ambition is to increase its hydropower production because they do have enormous potential, and this is something I wanted to talk about at the very end. The whole region has enormous potential in terms of hydropower, especially. It's extremely underused in case of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Serbia. You have the idea of building the hydropower plants on Drina River, which is something you always hear during the election campaigns. Politicians promising, yes, we are going to do it. Yes, we are going to do it. It would actually involve these two governments working together. But whenever the governments go into power, the project is dropped completely. They never actually put into practice the words that they say during the election campaigns. So renewable energy is a massive thing that all of the Balkans actually need to further develop. Looking at the European Union's 2030 climate change targets. I mean, the European Union is imposing, obviously, the ambition is to reduce the emissions of carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. There is a debate ongoing within the European Union. Each country have to subscribe to different limitations of the use of fossil fuels. In the Balkans, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. Politicians talk about it. There's various forums where they debate it. Nothing is actually put into practice, and this is one of the main criticisms of energy policies of countries of Southeastern Europe.
And solar power isn't being portrayed here at all.
Solar power, as you can see, it's very. No one is really looking at solar power. It has very limited application. But the thing with solar power is that it depends on the geography. I mean, you basically need flat land in order to build sort of the screens, the reflectors. So the only country that really would have potential for it in terms of, also the sun would be Macedonia, but they don't actually do it. And there's a number of reasons, for not having this. Investments, they require money. Second of all, corruption. I mean, you all know it very well. The great levels of corruption. And there's this stereotype, not only in former Soviet Union, Central Europe, but I believe in the Balkans as well, that the best way of enriching yourself is to get involved into construction, is to get involved into a construction project, because then you can really take advantage of the opportunity and basically steal money or resources. So yes, going back into the just the general overview of the energy mix, Montenegro is an interesting example. It's almost 50-50 in terms of their own production, but as you can see, they have quite a significant presence of oil and petroleum that they import. Serbia, again, mainly coal mine, a bit of oil that they produce by themselves, a bit of gas that they produce by themselves. They have the biggest part, the biggest gas is the biggest part of their energy mix throughout, you know, the whole region. The gas that they get comes mainly from Hungary, so it's Russian gas going through the interconnectors coming from Hungary. So they have a bit of their own gas, the rest comes from Hungary, and it's Russian gas. So a few very general words I wanted to say to the general public. Energy security in general is a very complex issue, which is, I mean, nothing very creative, nothing very new, but that's the case not only in Southeastern Europe but also in other European countries. It's not only about energy and resources. Energy security, as my previous research, my PhD research has shown, is never really about purely energy. There's always other issues that influence the perception of energy security and energy policy of a country. The way I explored it here, it's usually a result of interplay between domestic factors and various external influences, which you could see in the whole debate around pipelines. So countries that wanted to accommodate relations with Russia, either political or business, were more willing to support Russian pipelines, namely South Stream. Countries that put EU integration as their main political ambition were more willing to subscribe to the EU-backed pipelines, Nabucco, which failed, and Transadriatic Pipeline, which is actually being built. And the very last observation in terms of energy security, it's subject to short-term political dynamics. What do I mean by that? A new government comes, if it's a different party from the opposition in comparison to the previous government, they usually tend to have different ideas about the energy sector. Whereas in terms of energy likes long-term perspective. Because of the investments, it involves huge amounts of money. Building pipelines takes time. And this is one of the main complications in Southeastern Europe, the constant ongoing electioneering. When you have constantly election campaigns in all countries in Southeastern Europe, where election campaigns are mainly, one of the aspects of election campaigns is criticizing your neighbors. It doesn't really help regional integration, doesn't really help cooperation in terms of energy. And what I'll go later on into more detail is the energy union, which is the sort of European Union's idea of integrating the energy sector, is actually putting a lot of emphasis on regional cooperation. There is a great model of regional cooperation in the Baltics, in terms of interconnectors, but also similar regulation that helps investment. This is something that the European Union would like to copy in Southeast Europe. But this requires political cooperation, which is very difficult. Elections is one of the reasons of it. The main thing I wanted to discuss here was pipelines, the most visible, the most talked about topic in Southeast Europe in terms of energy. So South Stream, Nabucco, Turk Stream, and TAP. And the last point, which is something that I mentioned earlier, the 2030 agenda of the European Union in terms of reduction of CO2 emissions puts a lot of emphasis on investment in renewable energy and on the increase of energy efficiency. So these are the main issues that countries should tackle in terms of their energy security approach. But they are unfortunately largely ignored by the politicians and the media. You don't really see media or experts debating these things. So what I wanted to start off was with a sort of exploration of what energy security means. Now, Felix Ciuta, in his 2010 paper, presented energy security in its totality. Energy security as security of everything, everywhere, and against everything. It goes back a bit to the beginning of 2000s when energy security became a very fashionable topic. where it meant pretty much everything going from the issue of pipelines, diversification, gas, through the whole debate around climate change and global warming, to the particular types of energy, of resources that countries can use. So, for example, the whole debate about nuclear energy. One, seeing it as a major threat to the globe, the other seeing it as a significant part of the energy mix that's not emitting carbon dioxides, which is considered clean energy. So this led Felix Schutte to a conclusion that energy security is pretty much about everything, which is in a way matched by the experts, the World Economic Forum and the Cambridge Energy Associates. They defined it as an umbrella concept covering aspects related to energy, economic growth, and political power. In other words, something that may be a security issue for some, for others may be an issue of economic relations. To give an example of countries from Central Eastern Europe, for countries of Central Eastern Europe, energy security is an issue of security because of the Russian perception of Russian threat, whereas for a country like Germany, it's more an issue of economic relations. They basically want to have security of supply, of regular supply, so that they don't freeze in the winter, which is something that Kratochwil and Tichy explored in their paper, talking about asymmetric perceptions. Some countries can feel more dependent on different sources of energy or different types of energy, thus developing different perceptions. To make it in a very simple sentence, energy security can mean something different to an energy exporter who wants to sell its oil and gas and other resources, than to an energy importer who wants to have security of supplies. They want to have the guarantee that they will get what they pay for. Then to a transit country which receives a certain amount of money for the fact that the pipeline is crossing through its territory. When we look at Southeast European countries, they are mainly energy importers, but also supposedly transit countries. The thing I wanted to talk at the very beginning was what I call the great pipeline rivalry between South Stream and Nabucco. Now, looking chronologically, without going into much detail, Nabucco was the first one. European Union, at the very beginning of 2001, published a paper called Gulliver in Chains, where their interpretation was that European Union is chained to the same energy exporters, so it's importing from the same sources. Hence, it has to diversify to release itself from the chains put by the by these several countries. One of the ideas was to diversify supplies of gas. Now, Russia is the main supplier of gas to the European Union. It was also at the time receiving a certain amount of gas coming from Algeria, a bit from Egypt, Norway, but Russia was the main supplier. The idea of diversification in this case was to create a pipeline that would bring gas from the Caspian Sea, which would bypass the Russian pipeline network. So it was supposed to go, originally the idea was to bring gas from Azerbaijan through Georgia, Turkey, to the European Union, but European commissioners and different European statesmen got very creative, and there were different debates over possibly Iran providing some of its gas. There were trips to Turkmenistan trying to attract Turkmeni rulers to provide also gas and build a pipeline that would go through the Caspian Sea, which was obviously contested by Russia, but they did believe that this is an economically viable idea. The main theme of Nabucco was, as I said, diversification. So diversification from the main supplier, Russia. Obviously, Russia didn't like it, and they came up with the idea of South Stream. Now, it was an open secret, and this is, I think, agreed by many experts in the field, saying that the sole idea of South Stream was to provide a competing project to Nabucco in order, basically, to kill Nabucco. So it wasn't really thought through economically, it wasn't really thought through economically or financially, it was a purely political idea in order to kill off Nabucco, because obviously they wanted to maintain its dominance as the main supplier of gas to the European Union. And the main theme in the whole narrative that was produced around South Stream was reliability of supplies. Russia was saying that throughout the years they have shown that they are a reliable supplier. Hence, if European Union really requires, or countries around the European Union really want more gas, Russia has shown it's a reliable supplier, why won't you buy from us the extra amounts of gas? Now, there were two main episodes within this time frame. One was the 2006 energy crisis, when Russia cut off supplies to Ukraine. The other was 2009 energy crisis, when Russia again did this. Now, the way Russian narrative was explaining it, they were saying that this was a purely economic disagreement between Russia and Ukraine, even though it led to certain levels of gas supplies being cut effectively to countries of Central Eastern Europe. They were saying this was a purely economic reasoning. Now, if you want to avoid these situations in the future, that's why we need to bypass Ukraine, build an additional pipeline going through the Black Sea, because it was supposed to cross the Black Sea. Then we eliminate this problem of an unreliable transit country, namely Ukraine. So this was the second aspect of political reasoning of Kremlin in this case. So basically to bypass Russia, and the gas that was flowing through Ukraine was supposed to flow under the Black Sea in a new pipeline. Both ideas have died. In 2013, Nabucco was eventually abandoned when Azerbaijan, whose energy resource, whose gas was supposed to be the main product going through Nabucco, when Azerbaijan decided to pick TAP, Trans-Adriatic Pipeline, a competing pipeline, which was cheaper. Nabucco, the idea of Nabucco was to build a completely new pipeline going from Azerbaijan through Georgia, Turkey, whereas the idea of TAP was to use the already existing infrastructure going from Azerbaijan through Turkey to Europe and then build new pipeline from the border of Greece and Turkey. I'll show it in the map on a second. So what killed Nabucco was the decision of Azerbaijan to pick TAP. What killed South Stream was a decision of the European Commission that said it violates the third energy package, which basically meant, which just to simplify it, means that if there's a certain infrastructure, anyone can use it for its own produce, whereas Russia said, no, we are the owners of this pipeline, it's only Russian gas is going to flow through it, which is something that is against, you know, the competition regulations of the European Union. The European Union said, no way.
Yeah, can I interrupt?
Yes, sure. I'm simplifying, so if there's something I'm...
So my understanding is that the EU was open to the idea of the South Stream, and obviously many countries in the region were actually competing to get the South Stream passed through the territories. So how does this, when you say that, you know, the EU wanted Nabucco in order to cut off dependence from Russia, how on earth was the EU allowing this idea of South Stream to survive for too long?
Okay. So maybe.
Oh, if it's coming later, leave it.
No. It's not. It's actually a very good question. The idea of diversification. Well, why was both projects, which I'll explore a bit later, were pretty much virtual. So this is one reason. The other reason was I think pure competition. I think.
But you said that, so South Stream killed, okay, you didn't say that TAP killed Nabucco, but
you said
that South Stream was developed to kill Nabucco.
South Stream, because this was, the Russian division.
And then why did the Commission only issue the report that said, no, this is not, you know, sort of according to our standards, you know, whatever it was, 10 years later.
Yeah, 2014.
And didn't they say from the very beginning that, no, we have a supply from Russia, we need to diversify or whatever? It wasn't like a political thing?
It was pretty much a purely political thing. One of the reasons was that in both cases you had European energy companies being shareholders of both projects. So when you look at Nabucco, you had a You had the OMV from Austria, you had the Hungarian energy company, Bulgarian, Romanian and Turkish. Now when it comes to South Stream, it was the Italian Eni and Gazprom, who were the main force in Italy.
Maybe I can jump in.
Sure.
Well, you know, you asked why did the EU allow? I think the EU wasn't happy for this to happen, but Gazprom really went on a massive charm offensive with directly with the chiefs of each of the big energy companies. And annoyed because, for instance, there was a project in Trieste, it was based in Trieste, which was a sailing project financed by Gazprom. But around it, so there was the idea of Europe around the sailing project, but also they were actively inviting the chiefs, the heads of any of, you know, of the various German companies.
Yeah, BASF, I think, BASF was part of
and
this.
And trying to make them understand that there would be a stake for them, that it's a good deal for them. Yeah. So I reckon there was a sort of charm offensive that was trying to get the European individual actors on their side.
That's one of exactly one of the explanations, and obviously the shareholders, the big energy companies, in South Stream, they were lobbying their government in order to undermine the common European position. So obviously Italy was one of them, but also Greece, if I'm not mistaken, was a major, and Bulgaria, all of the countries that were supposed to be on the route of South Stream, but not exactly on the route of Nabucco. So for example, Bulgaria was heavily lobbying for South Stream because it was supposed to cross through their territory. Then Serbia outside of the European Union, yes, but then Hungary, then Austria. It was supposed to end in Baumgarten, if I'm not mistaken. So countries that were supposed to be on the path of South Stream were obviously lobbying heavily because they saw economic benefits of having the pipeline going through their territory. But one of the main criticism, maybe not criticisms, but one of the main objections to South Stream was that it was never really economically viable. And it eventually materialized pretty much in 2014 that, first of all, Russia didn't have enough money to put in to the project. All of the shareholders didn't really have enough money to put into the project. And the third one was it's not really clear how much gas resources Russia has. And some of these resources are in places where you have to involve deep sort of drilling, which means you need additional funding, you need additional resources. Meaning the price of oil and gas has to be at a certain level so that it actually makes sense for them to drill in these difficult to access places. For political reasons and with Russia's growing, you know, assertiveness in international affairs, this was becoming less and less politically viable. Yes, so even though both pipelines were never really built, both had an impact on political dynamics in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, and Southeastern Europe, well, especially on Serbia. Serbia supposedly invested 30 million euros in its bit of South Stream. They claim that they lost over 400 million euros, I believe, in future income. So this was a significant financial strain for Serbia. Nabucco died, to simplify it, being replaced by TAP, whereas South Stream was almost immediately replaced by the idea of Turkish Stream, a Russian response to the whole situation. Just to look at the map. The idea was for South Stream to go from Russia to Bulgaria. This idea was killed. So Russia's response was, if we can't do it to Bulgaria, because the European Union doesn't allow us to do it, let's do it to Turkey, because then European Union, what can they say? And then Turkey can sell it onwards, which would mean that different rules, this was the general sort of logic behind the initial assumption of building Turkish Stream. Now, when you look at the way the pipeline was originally supposed to be built, obviously this is a graph from the Gazprom's website, which shows underline, which shows Crimea as part of Russia. But as you can see, it really bypasses the territorial waters of Crimea. So even though Russia may consider Crimea as part of its territory, I think there's no coincidence that the pipeline is going like this, bypassing the Crimean territory, because, I mean, obviously, you never know what might happen with Crimea. So in their thinking, I'm guessing, it's a safer option to bypass Crimean territorial waters.
Interesting.
With the Gold Pipeline.
Presumably the plans were made before Crimea became...
Exactly. And I got this from the Gazprom's website already after the annexation of Crimea. So the map was obviously updated. So the basic idea of Turkish Stream is to provide Russian gas that would normally go through Ukraine to push it through.
This is still a plan.
It's still a plan. I'll go into more detail later on. I still feel it's a virtual plan. Many experts say it will never be built, but I'll talk about it in a moment. Now, this is the other pipeline, the Trans-Adriatic pipeline that I discussed that won the competition with Nabucco. So it's much more simple. It starts at the border between Greece and Turkey, and the new pipeline that was supposed to be built would cross through Turkish territory to Albania. Albania is, in these plans, supposed to be the main regional hub for energy. Part of it will go to Italy through the it's called an ITGI, Italy-Greece interconnector. The other part, which is not included in the map, would be the Adriatic Ionian pipeline, which would go from Albania north, Montenegro up to Bosnia-Herzegovina, up to Croatia. So this would be the idea of having the gas coming from Azerbaijan to go through Greece up to Albania and then go from Albania upwards to Montenegro, to Bosnia-Herzegovina, and to Croatia.
It comes from Azerbaijan.
Yes, it comes originally from Azerbaijan through the already existing pipeline network. So it goes from Azerbaijan. I didn't really find the full map, but it goes from Azerbaijan through Georgia, through the existing pipeline network, to Turkey, to Erzurum, which is the main energy hub in eastern Turkey, and then from Erzurum through the whole Turkey up to this point on the border between Greece and Turkey.
It's not built yet.
Yes, I mean, I believe it is. I believe it might actually be already in place. Now,
pipelines like above ground?
Yes.
Isn't that like, when you talk about energy security, you can't just like blow it up at any stage?
And this was one of the issues in 2008 when Russia invaded Georgia.
Exactly.
You have pipelines crossing Georgian territory. What are the names? BTC and BT, BTE. So Baku, Tbilisi, Ceyhan,
yes,
in Turkey, and Baku, Tbilisi, Erzurum. This is the gas pipeline. Now, apparently there was an attempt to blow up the pipeline. It crosses very near Tbilisi, the Georgian capital. So there was an attempt by Russians to actually blow up both pipelines in order to stop the flow of gas and oil.
I think
that
the pipeline also runs very close to Nagorno-Karabakh. So presumably if there's ever a
relatively
war,
close,
the Armenians can blow it up.
Exactly. I mean, it's not that close, but it's relatively close.
It's not that, it's like 12 miles or something.
Yeah. It's relatively close to the border. Because sadly I cannot show the map of Caucasus. The fastest way would be to go through Armenia, Nagorno-Karabakh. But for political reasons, Armenia, Azerbaijan, it's impossible for the pipeline to cross that territory, even though there was a long debate about a peace pipeline being built that would actually provide one of the links between both countries. It never materialized.
Do you have to have people patrolling it?
Pretty much, yes. Americans, who are the main force behind BTC and BTE, in the agreement it says that the country through which the pipeline is crossing is the main responsible actor for maintaining security. So they have special, basically, security forces that monitor these pipelines. This pipeline is partially underground, partially overground, but it's mainly overground. So you can easily see it. I think it's south of Tbilisi when you go to Georgia. And obviously the gas, because we are talking about the gas here, going through BTE, so Baku, Tbilisi, Erzurum, the pipeline is not used in its full capacity. So the gas that was supposed to go here would basically add into the pipeline. So there's enough sort of space in the pipe, let's say, for all of the gas to go through. And this is the idea behind this project. Right. So we saw it on the map. Right, now going into where the Turkey Stream and Tap can be actually built. The stories I've heard, I'm not a Greek speaker, but apparently during the Lavrov's trip to Athens recently, Turkish Stream was not mentioned at all, even though originally part of the pipeline was supposed to go through Turkey. Apparently it was completely dropped from the agenda. Also, when Putin visited Ankara, it was added to the talks at the very end as a sort of additional theme. Various experts in Turkish energy sector told me that this project is not going to happen. I mean, obviously Turkey is interested in it because Turkey has the ambition of being the main energy hub of Europe. They want to have all of the pipelines crossing Turkey because then they can control, then they can have a certain level of influence over this. So they are more than happy to accommodate Russian needs of having the pipeline going through there rather than through Ukraine. But the trick is, Russia doesn't really have money. According to different experts, it already tapped very heavily into its so-called rainy day fund, which is a fund that they created when the booming years of energy at the beginning of 2000s, when they made massive savings, basically income, on gas and oil that they were selling. Majority of this fund is depleted. Many people are saying that they might tap into the welfare fund, that this might be the next step for Russians to tap into the money put aside to pay pensions. And then, obviously, social unrest might follow. This is a bit of conspiracy theory thinking, I think, at the very moment, because it's very difficult to assess what is actually happening inside in terms of Russian economy, because we don't really know about it. But it is very difficult to say whether, there'll be enough. I mean, building a pipeline on the bottom of Black Sea is a massive investment. They don't really have funds for it. Supposedly, at the very beginning of October, there was a certain legal framework agreement signed between Russia and Turkey. That's what Gazprom was claiming in its press release, but it lacked any specific detail. It basically was limited to Alexei Miller, who's the Gazprom's CEO, saying that we've established a legal framework, which was signed in Istanbul, and that the document is extremely important. That's pretty much it. So it's just another memorandum trying to keep a pipeline, a virtual pipeline, as I say, and I'll explain in a moment, alive. Now, when it comes to TAP, construction officially began this spring, April, May, of the parts of the pipeline I was showing earlier, mainly in Albania. The first gas is expected to arrive in 2020, and recently you could find information that both Serbia and Macedonia are very eager to join TAP, which would basically mean building additional pipe, you know, interconnectors that would...
Who's paying for it?
I do have an answer to it. The main shareholders of TAP are BP. They own 20%. Sokar, which is the Azeri energy company, as well, 20%. And several infrastructure companies. There's SNAM, which is a construction infrastructure company, Fluxus, there's a Spanish energy company, and there's a...
It's not owned by the government, in other words.
Yeah, it's not owned. It's not owned by the government. It's private companies building it. But the very interesting thing about TAP, it's more of an anecdote, they do have London-based PR company doing the whole PR for them, because when I produced a paper on virtual pipelines, of signaling the idea of virtual pipelines a year ago, saying that TAP might be a virtual pipeline, meaning that it might not be built, I was immediately contacted by representatives of this London-based PR company who were really insisting on me coming to see them, talking to the experts, who would actually explain to me that TAP is being built, it's actually real, it will materialize, and whatever I'm saying is wrong, which is a very interesting sort of development, because this was a merely sort of a blog post and a meaningless place, but did lead to a very, very immediate reaction by the PR company behind it. So they are doing their best to maintain the vision, the idea of this pipeline being actually built.
You may need to speed up a bit.
Yes, okay, I'll speed up. So, why did I call them virtual pipelines? Now, just to simplify these very complicated definitions, I compared it to the Pokemon game you have on your cell phones. I mean, I'm not sure if this is the audience. sorry.
Definitely not.
But basically, it means superimposing a computer-generated image on sort of user's view of the world. So, in this case, superimposing non-existent pipelines on maps, images, producing images that influence our thinking. I mean, there might not be South Stream, or there might not have been South Stream, but we were treating it as a serious political project that had serious political implications, even though it wasn't there. Not much work was being done on it, but we considered it as a pipeline that didn't exist. I love this map from The Economist. Looking at the existing pipelines, which are the sort of straight lines, and the dotted lines, pipelines that are planned or upgraded. This is what I mean by virtual pipeline. You look at the map, and you put the line claiming that this is the pipeline that will deliver gas or oil from a certain point to a certain point, creating a certain image which might already influence political decision and political perceptions, looking at the region or looking at the politics that are behind it. Obviously, this map is a bit outdated because it shows Nord Stream as a sort of dotted line. Nord Stream obviously already exists. We have this black dots, which is an opal, which is a side interconnector. Just to quickly sum it up, what we understand as a virtual pipeline. Virtual pipeline, instead of my creative understanding, is something that exists only in discourse. It appears in memoranda, agreements, official statements, press releases, but actually never materializes. This is what we experience with Nabucco, this is what we experience with South Stream. Arguably, this is what we'll experience with Turkish Stream. Three different projects that we were taking seriously as serious political / economic / investment infrastructure projects, but they never really materialized. They are used as a tool of domestic or foreign policy, a motivator and a reward, also a tool of blackmail and extortion. What do I mean by that? One of my assumptions is that pipelines are one of the tools in Russian foreign policy. This is not only my assumption, but it's also an assumption of people working. To give you a very, I have it somewhere here. Yes, I have it here. Pipeline narratives are a part of Russia's information warfare. This is one of the assumptions of a great report produced by Center for Eastern Studies, which is a Warsaw-based think tank, one of the best think tanks when it comes to Eastern European affairs. Their conclusion was that everything that's being said around pipelines, even if they are not in the end built, is used by Kremlin to push its own information warfare on other countries, meaning that, especially in the case of pipelines being a tool of blackmail extortion, in case of South Stream, as I said earlier, one of the ideas of South Stream was to blackmail Ukraine, saying, listen, if you don't comply, we have an alternative. All of the gas that's going through Ukraine, you can push through the Black Sea. We don't really need you, unless you sort of follow the agreements or follow our line of thinking. We can push this gas that's going through Ukraine, we can push it through a different pipeline. Okay, I'll speed up. And a few sort of very general observations about virtual pipelines. The end result, the pipeline itself, is less important than politicization of the project, which is what I explained a moment ago. Potential recipients can only watch and react because decisions are made elsewhere. They're made in Moscow, they're made in Brussels, they're made in Ankara, they're made in Washington, but they're not really made in Belgrade. As I said earlier, Serbia lost approximately 30 million euros on the whole failed South Stream project. Kremlin is very keen to use the idea of pipeline. You could, right now, to a lesser extent, but a few years ago, almost every month you could hear about different ideas of new Russian pipelines. Nord Stream, Nord Stream 2, Turkish Stream, Eastern Ring, whether Yamal, which is crossing the Ukrainian territory, will be kept or not. Blue Stream, a new Blue Stream 2. In other words, Russians were putting up these ideas, signing memoranda, discussing various ideas for various pipelines. But when you sum it up, there's not enough demand in Europe for all of this gas, if all of those pipelines were taken seriously. Secondly, Russia doesn't have enough gas to fill all of these pipelines. So they were throwing pipelines, ideas of pipelines, as a part of negotiation with different countries or debating with different countries different ideas, knowing very well that these pipelines might never actually materialize. This is what I mean by pipelines being used as a tool in foreign policy of Russia. You'll be our friends, we'll provide you with gas, we'll build a pipeline. Well, obviously, you won't. But still, Russia was pragmatically using it, creating this image, this illusion that this pipeline might actually be created. Well, it wasn't only Russia doing these things. This was a very interesting thing. Once Vucic maybe slipped, or maybe he did it on purpose, and an interview to Associated Press, he admitted that when he was in Washington, the US was heavily lobbying for Serbia to actually join TAP, which is the West-supported, let's say pipeline. So it's not only Russia doing it. Apparently, obviously, Western European countries are doing this as well. And as I said earlier, the fact that South Stream was cancelled was a massive shock to everyone. I don't think anyone actually expected South Stream to be cancelled. Everyone took it as a serious pipeline, and many countries actually made significant investments into the pipeline, which only confirms the idea that even if agreements are signed and initial investments made, nothing can be certain when it comes to pipelines, especially Russian pipelines. Just quickly, limitations, which is something that I already discussed earlier, that pipelines are usually used in short-term politically driven projects. Although European Commission prioritizes energy diversification, energy union, which is the new catchphrase or the new idea for energy policy of European Union, is to look more inward, so to focus on renewable energy and energy efficiency rather than new grand infrastructure projects, rather than building new pipelines. And looking at the future, the European Commission estimates that European demand and Southeast European demand for gas will be actually falling, not rising. Which again questions why would the region need so many pipelines. Few other challenges: the International Economic Agency estimated that in 2015 the global energy investment went down by 8%, meaning that international investors are less likely to put their money into new infrastructure projects, pipelines, more likely to put money into energy efficiency. So in other words, no one wants to actually pay for new pipelines. The EU energy agenda, which is something I mentioned several times earlier, the idea of reducing emissions of greenhouse gases by 2030, this is something that's not seriously discussed in Southeast Europe in any of the countries. What we actually see in Southeast Europe is very limited investment in renewable energy for various reasons: barriers, infrastructure constraints, complex legal environments, and obviously corruption. Finally, there's a very slow push towards integration of regional markets, for reasons that I sort of explained, I was trying to explain earlier. There's limited incentive for countries to cooperate in the energy sphere in Southeast Europe when you have constant electioneering in all of the countries in the region.
But they're all members of the energy community.
Yes, they are all members of the energy community. And there are various, yes.
So electricity kind of is connected, no? Okay, it's not there.
It is slowly progressing. There's different fora for them to debate on these things. The Berlin process, yeah, which also puts the idea of investing in infrastructure. It puts it, I mean, I think this is at the very top of the whole agenda of Berlin process, to put money into investment in infrastructure. So there is some thought put into it. Supposedly there's some money put into it. Politicians are debating it, and I think they were debating it even here in London, in EBRD, during the conference when all of the prime ministers came. But when you look at the practice, nothing happens. I mean, they don't do it. They talk about it. They publish different papers, ideas, memoranda, but nothing is actually being done, or very limited work is actually being done in Southeast Europe. Another interesting observation they found, what you could call, inverted commas, questionable policy of international financing institutions. EBRD invested 48% in fossil fuels, mainly, for example, coal mines, only 23% in hydropower. So even though theoretically there is a push for clean energy, in practice, it does not happen. The other idea, which was, I think, Tim, you were, I said on your Twitter actually yesterday, about the World Bank supporting a new coal plant in Kosovo, another politically dubious idea, whereas there is a massive push for clean energy, and the World Bank puts one of the priorities, investment in clean energy, they put significant resources in a new coal power plant in Kosovo. I mean, again, lack of consistency in here. As I said, never-ending election campaigns, and politics tend to dominate over energy needs. The last slide, very quickly. Southeast Europe is more than just a gas corridor, because there is a massive potential for renewable energy. This is something I saw the first sentence at the very top. Hydropower is underdeveloped, grossly underdeveloped in Southeast Europe. There's a huge potential of generating additional electricity, additional energy from the rivers. It does not really happen. Drina, the saga of the hydropower plant on Drina is the most infamous project.
Can I just comment on that? I've read that EBRD is investing a lot of new dams and hydropower investments in the region, but it's come under heavy criticism because actually, although they may be clean energy, they're terribly environmentally damaging. There's huge sort of pushback against that.
Okay. Yes, and there wasn't a lot of problems in Montenegro, the Tara River.
I think
it's
yeah.
So it's not really a solution. It's not really clean in that sense. It might be an ecologically good thing. Yeah.
Okay. That's a very, very important. I have to take it into account. I'll be finalizing this. Right. But arguably there is a huge potential for energy, increasing energy efficiency. I mean, a lot of energy is being wasted. You do have good interconnectors still from the times of Yugoslavia between majority of the countries, but obviously more infrastructure is needed, especially, and everyone is saying, especially in terms of electricity. The electricity market doesn't really exist in the region. Countries lack a common master plan. They lack a common strategy, a common approach that made, for example, the Baltic states energy cooperation work. We don't really have it in Southeast Europe. And another opportunity is the whole energy union package. I mean, obviously, all of the countries are supposedly one day going to join the European Union. One of the ideas of energy union package is to prepare countries of the region in order to absorb legislation, rules, cooperation that will exist in the European Union, taking into account the 2030 strategy of reducing the emissions. So this is one of the aspects of preparation of the countries for further accession. So it does bring together aspects of security of supply, sustainability, and competitiveness to all member states and regions, but this is grossly underused in Southeast Europe. This would be the end. Thanks. Sorry for rushing at some point. I hope it's kind
of... I thought it was very informative, and, you know, like, personally, I know bits and pieces of different things, but, you know, that was a very, very useful kind of story that places everything into a picture. I have a couple of questions, but I'll open it up.
I do know they have to... This is just an initial... I know that there's more research that has to be done to it. For example, the aspect that you mentioned, this is something I have to remember, the criticism of... So the renewable energy projects that I have to take into account, because I would love to put it into a sort of proper paper and sometimes. So yeah, I mean, yeah, thank you for that, because that's something I didn't really acknowledge.
But there's also a controversy, I think, over is there an electric cable which is supposed to go between Montenegro and Italy?
There is, but the controversies are also, I think, environmental mainly. And there's also, in terms of TAP, which is something I didn't mention, there is a big opposition in Italy, again, environmental, about the pipeline going at the bottom of the sea for, obviously, environmental.
Is it fishing?
Yeah. Well, fishing is one thing, and also I think it's planned to go through areas, protected areas, environmentally protected areas. This is one of the controversies. That may delay the actual project. Yeah.
Kevin, do you want to ask?
I just wanted to perhaps ask you to elaborate a little bit more on the explanation for the absence of a common master plan. A regular theme in your presentation has been that it's politics,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder if you could unpack the politics a little bit more. You've said a couple of times that governments promise X, governments don't deliver X once in power. But there must be something more here in terms of the politics of segmentation, the politics of competition, whatever it might be, or politics which precludes the possibility of a common master plan. So.
Mm-hmm.
What is it political interests that prevents the emergence of a common master plan in a context where there is, as you said, so much potential, vast potential for hydro electricity, vast potential for renewable energy, etc., more potential for energy efficiency. So the objective interests, rational interests are there. I wonder if you could just unpack it, the black box of its politics.
Okay, I do have. I have it in my notes because
okay.
I did. I'll just have to find it. But
okay.
I can hear other questions. But I do have it in my notes. So if you give me a moment, I'll.
Could I add a second question?
Unpack it.
Yeah.
Okay. The master plan is one. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry.
Taking a view from outside, part of your story here is the strategy of Russia and of Putin. What I didn't hear much about was the extent to which Putin's strategy has remained consistent, the extent to which Putin's strategy has responded to events, etc. Sometimes, what I'm getting at is that sometimes in the West, we tend to, particularly in a Trump world, we tend to perhaps flatter the strategic overall
genius.
Plan.
Okay.
Genius. Thank you. The strategic genius of Putin. And I wonder whether your case is one which tells us something about adaptation, inconsistency, contradiction, whatever it might be, are we right to think of Putin's genius in this kind of energy politics?
Well, to answer the second question might be a bit quicker and easier for me, I hope, to answer. I would say flexibility. I would say Russia is very flexible and it adapts to the changing environment with its approach. This is how I would characterize it. It's very easy for Russia because you have one center of power, one decision center,
mm.
one country, very clear decision center. So it's very easy for them to make decisions and then implement them. But I think they have a very, not really regional approach, but I would say sort of a wider approach, which is very nicely seen in terms of Nord Stream 2, the other pipeline. Because Russia tends to shift. Like, one pipeline dies, they switch with the idea to another one. When it seemed that Turkish Stream is not really going well because of the spat conflict between Russia and Turkey when the plane is shut down, Nord Stream 2 idea suddenly reappeared. It was debated before, then it suddenly reappeared. And there was a serious debate about Nord Stream 2 being built. The idea was killed in the end, again. by certain member states, I think primarily Poland, opposing building the new pipeline. But what Russia managed to win in this is the increased flow of gas going through the first Nord Stream pipeline. So the first pipeline was used in 50%. It has a certain capacity. I don't remember the numbers, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, it was used in half of its capacity. But what European Commission agreed, I believe a few weeks ago only, is to increase the capacity of Nord Stream 1 beyond 50%. So Russia will be allowed to add additional 10 BCM, which is pretty much what is supposed to go through TAP pipeline. A significant boost. So, in other words, Russia didn't build a new pipeline, but it managed to achieve its goal, having more of its gas flow through the existing pipelines, which led some analysts to say that Nord Stream 2 was never a serious project for Russia. Mm-hmm. It was a decoy, because in the end, they knew what they really wanted to do. The objective was to increase the flow of gas going through Nord Stream already. So they used it as a sort of a decoy. So this is what I would say, that I think flexibility is the best explanation to Russian policy here, rather than consistency. Because I don't like this I think it's a conspiracy theory for me that Russia is so consistent ever since, you know, the fall of Soviet Union. I don't believe that, but I think by the fact that it's only one center of power, very much centralized, it's much easier for them to be flexible and make decisions faster. I think this is it. I'm not sure if I'm right, but
this is what I think. The closer proximity between the Gazprom, the firm, and the government.
Well, obviously, I mean, Gazprom is an arm of the Russian government. I mean,
Because in my previous question, you know, like the energy companies of Italy, whatever, would have different interests than the government of Italy.
I agree very much that. Oil and gas and pipelines are highly political instruments and so on, but I think, well, there's a couple of points really. One is, isn't it a bit sort of contradictory to argue at the one hand that the South Stream pipeline is a virtual pipeline, it was never meant to go into play or be constructed, and at the same time that it was Russia's policy to outcompete the Nabucco and TAP pipeline, which they could only do if they'd really been going to build it. And as far as I understood it, they got quite a long way with the construction of it. They'd ordered all the pipes for the Black Sea route, and then they were sort of shocked when the European Commission came along and said to Bulgaria, no, you can't do that because it's against the competition rules. And actually, it was the European Commission that sabotaged South Stream. It wasn't that South Stream was just some sort of virtual thing which was being used as a sort of decoy like that. And the other point is that, you know, you put a lot of emphasis on the sort of strategic duplicity of Russia and in using gas and so on. But, I mean, if gas is a political thing, then America, United States and the other players are also doing exactly the same thing. I came across this issue twice at conferences I went to. One was in Washington, conference on the Balkans, and it was at a time when the Nabucco pipeline was in trouble, and I was very shocked by the statements by the American statesmen and academics also. Why was the American government allowing Nabucco to be threatened by this, you know, Russian interference, and that they should do something about it, and they should sort of back Russia, get them out of the way.
Keep politics out.
And the other one, so the instance I came across this was at one of these EBRD investment conferences, and with, you know, all the prime ministers and Balkan prime ministers up there, and Thatcher on one end and Richard on the other end. And then before they spoke, somebody from BP got up and spoke and gave a long speech about the TAP pipeline. This is 3 years later. And I was also completely knocked over by it, because he was saying what it, a huge investment this was for BP. It's the biggest ever investment. It's a really massive thing for them.
Which I don't honestly believe it is, but yeah, I think it's part of the political spend, yeah.
Well, this is the guy from BP.
The point being that this is the biggest investment, because I think BP, the investments they made in Azerbaijan in the early 90s were much more significant.
Yeah. So, where I see it is that there is a real competition between the West and Russia over the supply of gas, and the Western interests want to get the gas in from the Caspian Sea, which they more or less own and control.
Yeah.
The Russian interests want to get their gas in from wherever they're taking it in Russia. And they're competing against each other for it. And the Southeast Europe countries, Serbia and Bulgaria, that's the sort of collateral damage.
Yeah.
It's very damaging for them.
Can you say anything about the... is it LPG? What is it?
LPG is the liquefied the liquefied gas.
Is that supposed to come to Croatia?
It is in Krk. This is a very interesting. Maybe you'll hear more about it. It's still not built. It's still not finished. This was a massive issue when HDZ came back to power. There was a big debate whether this is a strategic priority or it's not. The government wasn't really agreeing. It is being built. Yes, it is being built. But it's not finished yet. But Croats take it seriously as an additional supply source. And they want to obviously bring the LNG, which is a liquefied gas, from Qatar. Qatar is the biggest global exporter of liquefied gas. Also, America started to export liquefied gas. We'll see how it goes with, obviously, Trump's administration. But there is a growing market for, obviously, the LNG. But also Poland recently finished building its own LNG.
One thing I don't know is if the South Stream, the Russians refuse to open the actual pipe to other users, will the TAP pipeline be open to other users?
I think TAP will be.
Then they could also build a TAP pipeline across Bulgaria, couldn't they?
They could, yeah. I mean, not the pipeline itself, but I think that there's a sort of interconnector that might be built to Bulgaria. I mean, obviously, all of the countries of the region are trying to pitch in to join the idea.
It sounds like
that's
why. Is really gonna be
that's why Macedonia wants its sort of.
It makes sense to have no gas.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen earlier in the sort of presentation, Macedonia doesn't really have. I think it's very limited.
But there's no.
That comes from Bulgaria.
They can't get any.
I think it goes from Bulgaria. The Russians are going through.
Okay.
I think it goes. I think this is the interconnector. And Serbia obviously wants additional gas as well, which is part of their own strategy, because gas is seen as a cleaner energy than coal. So, I mean, in the first slides you've seen that gas was very limited, because there's no gas. Yeah, exactly. There's no gas. There's no gas out there. It's mainly in the north, in Vojvodina. But what I want to say, yes, I mean, absolutely. This is the thing I have to, as a Polish person, I have to. Try to be more analytical as well. I was speeding, this is a lame excuse, but you're absolutely right. I mean, Russia is using all of its potential, as you know, resources are a tool which they use pragmatically in their foreign policy. I mean, this is what they do. I mean, it's maybe I was too critical of it, but it's a perfectly rational sort of behavior, and US is using its own tools for its own pragmatic reasons. So That's why I was trying to put through the message that energy, in case of Russia, it's not only about the supply itself or the economic rationale behind it, but it's also about politics. But on the other hand, so it is for the European Union or for Washington. Energy is a pragmatic political thing. And you had a massive debate around the pipelines that cross Georgia, the ones that I mentioned earlier, BTC and BTE. Economically, they were not viable. But there was a big push from, if I'm not mistaken, Bush administration. Dick Cheney was the main person behind it, saying this is for geopolitical reasons. This has to be built, even though it's not profitable economically. They have to be built, and they built them, and they operate as an additional source, an additional route of oil and gas coming from the Caspian. But it wasn't an economically viable. It was a purely political thing, which many Russian analysts always point out. When you say South Stream or Turkish Stream is politically motivated, they say, hold on, BTC, BTE, they were also political. Same logic. What they were saying is that the actual investment you have to put into building this pipeline, because you have to bypass Armenia, go through Georgia, mountainous areas, go down to Turkey, the whole investment you put in the return that you get from the gas if it goes through is, you know, in a very long time perspective. So it's a more of a long-term investment than using the existing Russian pipeline system. So this was the rationale.
Do
you want to come back to the...
The master, yes,
okay.
Sorry, yes, so yes, yes.
What's the academic explanation, then?
I think there's more of an analytical explanation, because I took the idea of the master plan from a great report by the Center for European Policy Studies, who promoted this. And I took it written somewhere. If I don't find it, I'm more than happy to tell you a bit later.
Okay.
Because but I really would like to find them to answer your question.
I want to ask a question.
Okay,
but then
so I will look for it. Sorry, it's my ignorance that I didn't write it down.
I'll throw my question in. The premise is this is politics. But then you mentioned, we can easily have a discussion about Russia and geopolitics, but also you mentioned every now and then the politicians and the electoral cycles, and you know, have too many looks. So it was more like domestic politics, links to the question.
That's the same question.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you meant this as how domestic politics respond to geopolitics, so you have a pro-Russian party and pro-EU party or whatever, or if you meant that there's different interests within countries, and then these are expressed differently and stuff, but it's not in relation to geopolitics, it is in relation to whatever is local. So is it...
I think it's the other point, because one of the my personal criticism of all of this is you take too much of a global approach to different initiatives without looking into particularities, and different domestic dynamics, like different interests or different interest groups play into it. So this is what I actually meant, that this sort of domestic dynamic of different in terms of different interest groups having different sort of ideas, rather than this very grand geopolitical approach. So in a way, I think this might be partially the answer to the other question. The fragmentation, especially in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the administrative chaos that exists in Bosnia and Herzegovina really makes it more complicated to make to work out.
And then my other
more significant
question.
Regional cooperation. Yeah. But I look for the master plan.
And then. I would think that the issue of energy supply sort of lends itself to geopolitics. Yeah, it's who I get the gas from and whatever. But most other things in energy policy are more domestic. And if you think energy efficiency, you know, what is the geopolitics of energy? So is the domestic politics or quality of governments, you know, capacities, more of an important factor on the other area, so energy, let's say energy efficiency, because obviously if in the geopolitics between whatever it is, Berlin, Moscow, and Washington,
efficiency depends on the country.
What
itself.
Can Serbia do?
Yeah.
You know, what can
sure,
they?
Sure,
how
sure,
can they play
sure.
out? But on issues of energy efficiency, you know, they have.
They can do that themselves. Yeah.
So is this a different animal altogether? You know, is this kind of a different paper, a different thesis, or does it make sense to put all, you know, energy into one category? Yeah,
it's complicated. I think this is the easiest explanation. I think it should be further sort of looked down on a more sort of domestic country basis rather than this global thing, because I do believe, and from what I understand, that issues of energy efficiency they depend on the particular countries. That's not a part of the great geopolitical battle between the West and Russia, but it's
but these are more part of the cooperation processes that are linked to
they are linked to that are linked to I would say regional cooperation linked to accession.
And I think even I'm not actually sure, I should know that, but even Southeast Europe 2020 must have targets for carbon emission,
because
no?
Southeast Europe, as part of the energy community, they subscribe to the priorities set by this 2030 energy unions framework plan. Yes. So, but by the fact that they sort of subscribe to the energy community, which is an organization basically which promotes implementation of these of the energy union package and of the goals. Yeah. Plus, if they want to be a member, they have to meet the criteria.
Yeah,
so it's pragmatic.
Okay. Other questions or comments?
Master plan. I will.
Okay.
I'm really sorry, but.
Right. Jarek, thanks for this very, very informative presentation. I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did.
No,
we learned a lot.
I hope you didn't find it too chaotic.
No, very good.
If you did, thank you for lying to me.
A welcome by the audience. Thank you.